This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
An 18-year-old takes a boat out to Horn Island on the 4th of July, along with about 300 other people. A lot of them kids he grew up with in Ocean Springs, teenagers, young people out doing what young people do. 2 days later, a park ranger finds his body in the water off the northwestern tip of that very island. The friends came home. Nolan didn't. And almost every message we've gotten comes down to one question. How do you leave somebody's child on an island 10 miles from shore? That's the big one. Today, we're going to go through your questions, so be sure to drop them in the comments as we're doing this live. And if you're catching this after we air it, drop your questions there, too. We read them all throughout the day, and we will try to address them here as we work through the story as we continue to cover it. The links are in the description, Substack, YouTube, some of the best places to do it. If you're watching us live, X, Facebook, all that. Let us know your thoughts. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program with us. As always, not a lot over the weekend. There is going to be some movement on this week, without a doubt. We're likely to see possibly the autopsy results. There's a grand jury convening. That doesn't mean something criminal is happening here. It just means that's how they look at any sort of case where there's some questions involved. So there's going to be some pivotal things likely happening this week. I'm not going to speculate on those yet because we just don't know. They could go any which way. Mm-hmm. We'll follow them wherever they go. I want to address some of the questions that are still out there and really kind of just parse through them, because it's easy in this case. The more I talk about it, the more I'm digging. It is easy to get onto one train and start riding it this way. And you go, whoa, wait a second. Let me jump over here and see it this way. Oh, okay, you're making a lot of sense too. But they're both going very divergently different ways. But if you really look at both of them, there's certainly valid questions on every side of this and valid thoughts on every side of this. The problem is we just don't know the answers. Mm-hmm. I keep coming and thinking about the boat ride home. A lot of people are. Somebody looked around. Somebody saw he wasn't there. And that's not even a question. From what we understand, the boys were under the understanding, again, according to them, we're going off of what that story is, that they were told, he said, I'm going to go get a ride back. I'm going to go after this girl over there. Even if Nolan said he'd catch another ride, everyone, parents, lots of people who weren't there saying, you don't just leave. You just don't. Well, you just, and all that, whatever. So why did every single one of them go? Why did they leave their friend back on the island? I think I have some pretty simple answers for it. I'm curious as to what your answer is for it.
So you said a lot of great things, as you always do, Tony. So valid questions, but we need to always maintain openness to conclusions because we just don't have all the facts and data yet. But on that question about leaving behind, let's go down the road of thought experiments with human behavior, because mm-hmm. it's easy, like you said, to go down these different paths. Because how do we go down different paths? So we take a starting point and we start filling in details about what we think we would do in hindsight with 2020 without ever having to experience that ourselves. And what I mean by that is the first time you go through a truly fear-motivated moment, you don't know what you're going to do until you move through that fear-motivated moment. You reflect. You say what I would do differently next time, and then you get a rep, and then you do it differently next time. I know this. Every single first responder out there knows this. You know, the first time a cop pulls up to his first car stop and things look a little different than he's facing in training, I can tell you fear hits them about what's this going to do? What's this person doing? Why does this person pull over to the side of the road this way? Until you start establishing a pattern of behavior, and that fear is no longer fear, it becomes experience. 9/11 in New York, I watched people jump from the North Tower. I saw people running in chaos. I had management telling me, if you fear for your life, run, because they didn't have a rep in dealing with chaos yet. So when chaos hits, fear hits, and people respond to fight or flight, and they're always going to act in their own best interest in terms of their safety, security, and prosperity from their own point of view, from their own experiences in those moments. I use that as the backdrop to the facts that I see, that we're seeing so far, is we are seeing no significant wobbles in relationships, because I go to relationships first. We're seeing friends. We use those words friends because these people cared for him. There's no leakage saying that there's some strife, there's some animosity. Now, granted, there's some back and forth. We're seeing some fight here, an argument here, whatnot, but we're not seeing any precursors before this, like he's on a boat with an arch enemy or a frenemy or anything like that, because if we did, there'd be more data to go on. What happens, though, is especially when we listen to the call and we got the data and the GPS of not just a leak in a boat, they, from my optic, if you want to go glass half full, that these is just a horrendous, tragic event. If they feared for their boat sinking, they feared for their lives, you become extremely tunnel vision if this is your first rep in doing something like that. And what happens when you get tunnel vision, people, places, and things kind of drop off. And you, it's easy for our brain to rationalize, oh, they said this, so I don't have to worry about that, so I'm going to focus on this. Mm-hmm. And this is what we might be seeing here as one, as you said, as one possible route going down. I cannot wait for us all to get the results of the autopsy. Yeah. To verify, hopefully verify for everyone, for the parents, all the other people involved, that it was a tragic drowning, an accident, and that hopefully the independent autopsy that the family is doing is going to be congruent with that, because that would be the thing I think brings everyone the greatest peace to be able to move through this tragic event, but only time will tell.
That autopsy, and both autopsies, is I'm hopefully they line up and that they're, you know, congruent with each other. If they're not, I think that's going to cause more chaos.
Yep.
It will be what it will be. The Coast Guard call I want to hear, which we have not heard yet, that was the one where the Coast Guard waited 13 hours for going out. I'm not the Coast Guard. I don't know how that stuff works. As a layperson, I go, you get a call and there's a missing kid on the island and you're 13 hours later, you go out? Like, what the hell is that all about? Maybe there's a reason. Maybe they get these calls all the time and it's like, well, it turns out 98% of the time it's somebody's on the island or they just didn't hear from their friend or they're drunk or who knows? Is that reason enough not to go out because 98% of the time it goes this way? I don't know. Again, all of that 100% conjecture from my brain that I just spilled out there.
Right.
But we just don't know the answer. So I'd like to know that. Not that I think the Coast Guard is like conspiring with anybody, but I think that might be a question of response and how that is handled. And maybe that should be examined. Maybe it shouldn't. I don't know the answer.
And how many other calls are coming in at the same time, too? All the data we don't have yet.
All of that needs to come in. There's questions there. What we're not seeing, I think, tells us a lot. Again, my conjecture on this, not that it's worth anybody more than anybody else's, but the way that some of this is being painted, and there seems to be this absolute certainty from some that this was some sort of racially motivated attack from his friends. I mean, if you look at some comments, you'd think he went out with a Klan for a day on the water. It's like, no, that does not appear to be this whatsoever.
Right.
These friends, many of them of all races, have said, we're a pretty diverse group of kids, as most groups of kids are these days in almost any part of the country. If you haven't seen high schools as of the last 20 some years. And the issue of race, not as big of a deal as it's been to generations 20, 30, 40 or more their peers, because there is so much more intermingling of everybody, which is a wonderful thing. So it's not this against that. I mean, because a good chunk of everybody's a little bit of everything in many cases, which I think is wonderful. So this idea that this is some sort of racially motivated thing, okay, if there was, let's just go down the road of if it is, and again, I don't know the answer to that. Could it be? Sure, anything is possible right now. But if it was, if there was a track record, if there was enough here that this group of friends decided for whatever reason they're going to kill their black friend, And then everyone's going to lie about it and not talk about it. wouldn't you see, I mean, wouldn't you likely see some sort of, number one, leakage on that? It's a group of people. But number two, leading up to this, I would imagine at this point in time, we're talking 2 weeks out since this occurred, and teenagers with phones and everybody who records every damn thing in the world, you don't think if there would be 1,000 videos out there of these friends doing nasty things to their black friend or saying things on camera, that there would be a track record of this if it existed? I would think that would have come out by now, or there'd be some leakage of it somewhere. We've seen nothing of the sort. So that's where I'm going to, is what we're not seeing is telling me, at least in my gut at this moment, that these friends are probably telling the truth, that they don't know what the hell happened to their friend. And they're more heartbroken than anybody else, because this is their actual friend. We're people on the outside. And if that's true and they lost their friend and they don't know what the hell's going on and the world's going, you might have something to do with this. My God. I can't imagine what that's like. Now, look, I'm saying it could go any which way, but if we're looking at it from that perspective, what we're not seeing seems to be pretty loud here.
Yeah, and I agree. So things like racism aren't one-offs. You know, if there was a racially motivated intent here, there would have, like you said, there would have been leakage before, there'd be leakage after, there'd be, and again, that's just from what we're seeing in social media. It's what we're seeing being portrayed right now. So
could be wrong.
And if now if we see text messages and things come out after they do the digital forensics on this and it supports another conclusion, okay, then we take that in and we shift.
Yeah.
But as of right now, I don't see it. I go past as prologue. If you're not seeing it in the past, the likelihood of it being present today is it's always a maybe, but it's very, very slim. Now, and you brought up the parents on this. Well, actually, one of the listeners did. Yeah, absolutely. Because so the parents are different generation, more like our generation or yours, Tony, maybe not up to mine yet. But again, generational things are different. And so they don't live the daily life with their son. They don't know. Like, I'm very aware of my kids' friends. My kids are adults. But I wasn't as granular on it about the words, action, the deeds of their friends. I just had a general tenor of them and how they got along, the types of relationship they had. And so if you're a parent and you went through, especially in Mississippi, some racially trying times, no doubt, would you want to ensure that this wasn't a thing? Absolutely, you would. I don't fault anyone for anyone's actions so far on anything. I think the public's getting a little more hyperbole without, because they're jumping to, they're filling in gaps, in other words.
And that seems to be like the dangerous thing with all of it, is that part. I in no way fault invest. You ask the freaking questions. Mississippi's got the worst track record of our country of covering up horrible things done to black people, without a doubt. I mean, it was like Emmett Till, it was like 2023, one of the cases recently. I just did a piece on this the other day where it was like finally like recognized that it was wrong. It was like, it took up until like 5 years ago to like recognize. I mean, it's insane. It's utterly insane. So is it wrong to examine it from that angle? Not at all. Please do.
Yep.
Examine it till the nth degree to make sure. But investigating it and asking the questions is not the same as it is that.
Yep.
And that you're going to get to the, you can't go into that going, I'm going to ask these questions and here's where I know it's going to land. No, you don't know where it's going to land. That's why you're asking the questions. And it's good to be asking the questions. The problem is when the public is going, I know how it should land, how I want it to land, how my conjecture feels like, because that's going to elevate me and my posturing to the world of me being, whatever the hell they want to be, over others. That's the scary part with something like this, because it seems to stir up, the least critical thinkers of our population.
Yeah, it's what we do. I mean, you start seeing patterns of behavior that will support the conclusion you've already come to. And that's why, again, going to your very first thing, I wrote it down, valid questions, but not coming up with any kind of conclusions until you keep taking in data. And you can got to keep going down the road of maybe. You don't rule anything out. But as of right now, as of everything we're seeing a lot of congruency with a group of good friends that made some tragic choices on a day that I think they don't want to relive. And so the rep that they got out of this, so seriously, do you really think any one of these individuals involved would ever do anything to leave someone behind in any aspect of their life again?
No. I mean,
and so it's a horrible way to get a life rep, but everyone has been not self-centered in this. They've been focused on the victim. They've been focused on the victim's family, and they're taking a lot of threats. It's really tragic, sad, but unfortunately not unexpected from what we see on a lot of these cases.
I know. I mean, it's any way you look at it, it's just, it's
horrendous.
Another question here. It says, my son is 19, swims like a fish, and I haven't slept right since I heard the story. Nolan was a college football player, young, strong, healthy. Everyone keeps saying drowning like that explains... everyone keeps saying drowning like that word explains everything. Does that sit right with anybody? Basically, how does this happen? Well, riptides. I mean, how did he get out to the riptide? I don't know. We don't know the answer to that question. But the thing is, once you're in one, you're kind of screwed. And it doesn't really matter how young, strong, and healthy you are.
Yeah, and when it comes to swimming, I speak from a lot of experience on this. I am a swimmer.
Yeah,
I swim every day. And I swim every day. I it's not a me moment. Triathlons, long distance swimming, and we have a group at the YMCA, a group of very, very healthy, fit people that are new triathletes, new boxers. I mean, boxers. You can't get more fit than a boxer in a lot of these things. And I watch people that look just like Nolan, his fitness level from football and everything else, come in and sink like rocks. I'm trying to remember what channel I watched this on. This was actually recently, I think it was on Discovery, where they actually ran a competition to see, to demonstrate how hard it is, the difference between swimming in a pool, and they had a bunch of people, they had a dancer, I think, a ballet dancer, they had a football player, and all these different young 20-somethings get in a pool and try to do 100 yards. They struggled, extremely fit 20-year-olds struggled to do that. Then they said, all right, now you're going to go do the same distance in the open ocean. They all had to be picked up but one. And so it's hugely different. Just because you're fit doesn't mean you're fit to swim. There's a huge difference between swimming, and especially if now you throw in 4 to 5 mile an hour riptide, which the research I did the other day shows that it can get that fast out there, which is faster than a regular human being can swim. And then a regular human being that isn't a seasoned swimmer that does it every single day cannot maintain that kind of pace probably for more than about 5 minutes. Seriously, and if you don't think I'm right on this, go in a pool, go to your local YMCA. If you're not a swimmer, see how long you can actually do a lap and keep yourself afloat for. And so it does not surprise me that he was overcome by water if we don't see any of the data points, because you can be as fit as you want to be in the world, but if you're not a swimmer and you're caught in a riptide, you can be seriously in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it happens very, very fast. How he got back out in the water is the question. Here's what I've been kind of wondering. This is what was going to my mind over the weekend and talking about this. So he tells the girl allegedly that he's going to go get a ride back with his guy friends. Tells his guy friends allegedly that he's going to go hang out with the girl. Can both be true at the same time? I think they might be able to be true at the same time. I could see it like him telling his friends, I'm going to go hang out with a girl. Gets out with the girl, and maybe I need that ride back, and the boat's gone. I don't know. There's a lot of ways in real life how this could go down that aren't just the choose-your-own-adventure book, and it's this or that. It's somewhere in the gray area.
I like it. Yeah, you're
and,
right.
And it's not, you know, it's not what he was intending either, but somehow he ends up on the island without a ride back. And who knows what happens after that? I'm not so much suspicious of the group of friends that has no track record of anything negative against their friend at all. I'm wondering, who did he meet on the island? I'd be looking more in that lane. And we haven't really heard much about that lane other than the girl that he was interested in. If we're going to go down a road of people being involved here, I would be wondering, what group of strangers might he have gotten involved with that I don't know, maybe didn't feel the same way about someone of his race as his own friends did, which his own friends seem to, you know, everybody's okay, everybody's good, everybody's equal and on the same footing. Maybe he ran into some folks that didn't have that same sort of feeling and were shitty human beings. Or maybe he met up with some strangers and they did and everything was fine, but there was a horrible accident and nobody wants to be responsible for that happening to the stranger. Ranger kid that came up and was hitching a ride with him. There's a lot of possible motivations here as to why people may not be talking. And it doesn't necessarily equal it being anything to do with race, other than it may have a lot more to do with people not wanting to be accountable for whatever happened. If anything happened, if anybody even knows anything, could Nolan have gone back out into the water? He's there. He's with the girl or whatever. Maybe he can't find the girl. I'm going to go swim more with all the people out there, and gets caught in the riptide, taking a moment by himself. Oh, it's kind of nice. And then whoosh, gone. Nobody knows. Nobody caught it. There's a lot of possibilities here. But I am wondering about, you know, who else was on the island that day, and what sort of footage we're going to find and what we're going to see as evidence pops up. Where do you think that's going to go?
Yeah, from what I understand, I think, what was the number, Tony? I think it's like 60 people have been interviewed is what I saw so far.
That's what I've seen, yeah.
So that's good. So we're talking a lot of people, because basically from what you laid out, and I completely agree, the friends aren't giving us wobbles. We're seeing a consistent pattern of behavior from them. So I'd be focused on where we have blanks of data, which is what happened on that island after the friends left. And so you get that blanks starting to be filled in when you do the interviews. If I know we had limited cell reception here, but if there's any way to get pings, you can see what cell phones are present. You could actually identify through national security letters or subpoenas without being too intrusive. So you don't really need much to get, say, identify which cell phones are present. So you can actually identify who to interview. So that's what they're going through right now to start piecing together and filling in the blank data points that are going on that island after the friends left. Because I think that's where we're really all questioning right now.
Yeah.
Because if you keep drilling down on the friends, I think you're going to keep coming up with what you're coming up with. Not a lot of new information.
Well, I see a comment here. Some of your scenarios are far-fetched. Yeah, I mean, some of them may be. But so nobody saw this kid in distress. That's the point. Most drownings, nobody sees it happening statistically. That's a fact. And you may not like it. It may not go with the narrative how you think drownings work, but it's how they work. That's why they're drownings. Because suddenly the person's just gone and they don't see the person, especially in a riptide. So yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. It's how drownings work. It's a fact, whether it's this case or any case, most of them are not noticed. That's how it goes down. And that's the scary part of this is, and that's what I wonder too. Yeah. So let's just for a moment say,
and I'm sorry. And one second there too, when you think about it, cause the way you laid it out with all the friends there, if you actually saw a couple of video clips, people aren't paying attention to water. They're paying attention to all the chaos and all the partying and stuff going on the beach. And so if someone slips into the water, it could very potentially go unnoticed. Anyway, to your point.
Especially if they are moving around and it's a large group of people and nobody notices there's anything wrong because there's so much chaos going on at that moment in time. But let's say, here's another scenario. Let's say nobody saw him in distress. Let's say people did see him in distress. You got 300 some people around and you're telling me that every single one of them or whatever group, let's say there's 5, 10, whatever, strangers, complete fucking strangers, see some kid out in the water in distress. You don't think they're going to be talking about that? Mm-hmm. They had nothing to, you don't think they're going to be like, my God, yes, I saw him. He was out there. He was drowning. You'd have people saying that right away. You're not going to get a bunch of strangers going, shit, we saw somebody we didn't know drowning out there. Nobody say a word.
And it all wasn't just
what kind of scenario is that?
I know, and it's all not just one group out there. There's multiple different groups. This is a big conglomeration of people that go to this island, and so there's no way you're going to get one ringleader to silence a bunch of people. Conspiracy theories and trying to get a large number of people to comply with lying and deception and hiding agendas. It doesn't work.
So if he did drown in the public sphere where there's people, no one saw him.
Right.
I just don't see any scenario where somebody would have seen him and not said, oh my God, I saw this kid out there drowning. They're not like, well, he was a black kid, so I'm not going to report that. No, I just don't buy that at all, that nobody would say anything. now, could there be a nefarious area to this? Yes, but I don't see it being in a public sphere where everybody's seeing him drowning and just like, continue on with the party.
Right.
I see, I mean, if he was out privately with some people with strangers or something that he didn't know. If something went down, okay. But again, that seems like a somewhat far off scenario too, where people who are out partying one day decide to pick up the stranger and murder him. Like, hey, let's murder the black kid that came on the boat that asked for a ride back, and then let's go out to Applebee's. You know, it's doesn't make sense much either.
And so here's what's really good from an investigative standpoint, I think, is going to help everyone come to a conclusion eventually, is because when they've done approximately 60 interviews, it's a very, very tight group of people that have been there. In other words, it's not like people coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. I really think so. You go out there on a boatload of people, and if you have just, say, each boat can carry like 4 to 5 people.
Yeah,
that's a typical bow rider. It's a typical pontoon boat. It's a typical boat that goes there. And so if you only have one person on each boat being able to identify who else was on that boat, which is a high probability, you now know who to interview. And so the interviewers are now, what are they doing? They're baselining, looking for wobbles. They're looking for data. Yeah. They're looking for cell phones. They're looking for everything. They're looking for incongruencies in stories. They're looking for all the data would see, all right, here's a group that, all right, we can move on from this group. We can move on from this group. We might have a little wobble in this group, so we're going to focus in on this. And so I think that's because it is a very, I wouldn't say controlled environment, but it's not like you have thousands of people that you're trying to identify that have been coming and going. I think it's going to be a very, very much more manageable group of people they can conduct interviews with. Again, my conjecture, not being on that island, but from what we're seeing and what I'm seeing as of right now, I think that they have a really high probability of getting to the ground truth of what actually transpired eventually when they get all the interviews done, they get the autopsies done, the two autopsies done, and they conduct all the interviews that are available.
Yeah, I mean, like I'm saying, anything is possible, but I think we need to look at things from a logical lens on the ground and not, whew, let's get caught up. And that's what we're trying to do. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll follow it wherever this leads. The 100%. Same day a park ranger pulled Nolan's body from the water, the sheriff was already telling the public no foul play was suspected before the autopsy, before toxicology, before almost anything. Whatever trust this investigation had, it cracked right there. Two autopsies sit unreleased. An independent team is digging through his phone, and a grand jury is waiting. And when investigators told Nolan's parents it was most likely an accidental drowning, his mother asked the same question you did. Why are we so quick to rush this? Yeah, I think what I wonder about with this case is half the problem occurring after the fact. People in places of power where words matter saying stupid shit. And I mean, that seems to be where, you know, a lot of it's already, you know, this is just tinder waiting to be lit. And when you're in the pack of tinder and you are potentially a match, you got to be careful with where you stick your head towards the sun or towards a source of heat. And when you say shit like no foul play expected out of the gate without an autopsy done, that might ignite the whole pile, which I think it did. Now, does that mean when somebody says something stupid like that, that then the entire apparatus of people that would be part of that conversation, does that mean that narrative is then immediately true? No, it means somebody said something really stupid that doesn't necessarily match up with reality and should be judged strictly on the person who said it, why they said it, how they said it, and the answer might just be ignorance. What's your take on the sheriff? Because obviously a lot of people are still making a big deal about that. You know, the sheriff hasn't continued seemingly to go down this road.
Right.
So it seemed to be, I don't know if I'd say deviation, but it wasn't like he continued to dig in the way Nanos has over in Guthrie. It was like, okay, never addressed saying kind of stupid shit, but also didn't continue to say stupid shit either.
Yeah. Even from day one, anytime I do research on a case, I research everyone involved in a case, the victim's family, the friends around them, and as well as the investigators. And so when I said this on day one and two and ever since, you know, I did a deeper research as much as you can online about the sheriff. He went to National Academy. He does not have a bad reputation. He's got a lot of good, non-Nanos traits, we'll say, in him. And so then you got to look at, all right, so what's the intent of what he said? What's the impact of what he said? And how did he come to that conclusion? What inspired that person to say these things that, like you said, it lit a tinderbox? And I believe, you know, unintentionally, because people don't want things to get worse, because he made things more challenging for him and his investigators by doing that. And so what do I think the intent was? Behaviorally, based on his arc of his career, I think the intent was to calm nerves from the onset because he's seen these things go sideways. And unintentionally, not knowing that he's going to make it worse by saying it that fast.
Yeah.
Now, then what drew him to make a statement like that? Years of law enforcement, years of talking to people, doing interviews, seeing these types of things play out in the past. My guess, again, pure guess, pure conjecture, is that when he first talked to the people involved, the teenagers, the everyone involved, his, I won't say gut instinct because guts are just emotions, but I think his inclination because of his experience, his first impression was that this is not foul play because of I didn't see all the things we've been talking about. He didn't see the data supported foul play. Now, what did he should have done? Hold that opinion and see if in the days doing the investigation that theory of his personal theory would play out. I think he was quick to the gun because he's trying to calm, you know, the sentiment on this one, but wound up inflaming it by mistake. And that's why he's not doubling down on it. He's just being silent. He's like, whoop. Not so in my mind, there's nothing else he could say to make it right except shutting up. And so, again, I always in situations like this, when again, if you've never dealt with a situation this big, when it's not just a loss of life, but a lot of other factors in play, and your public relations person that you have in your department doesn't have experience in it at the level either. I mean, they train for this at National Academy, believe it. They train their sheriffs, they train their executives on how to deal with situations like this. And when they get a bloop, the next thing you're watching is what do they do in response to saying something that really fanned the flames or threw kerosene on the fire. And so far, he hasn't doubled down on stupid like Thanos did. So far.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, and look, people are human. They're going to say things that, you know, are not intentional. They should be more measured, but it is what it is. That's what you get when you have humans involved in things, and we happen to be humans. So that tends to be the track that goes down.
And
that.
You very well might have had a loving critic to bounce this off of, but if your loving critic has no reps in this either, you're kind of flying blind, and I think that's what might have happened.
Let's talk about the phone for a second, because that's another big thing people are very critical of, because, well, Ben Crump has made it a big deal and has positioned it as something very suspicious. And look, investigate it. Go to Snapchat, find out if things were actually deleted. And if the answer is yes, you got some reason to ask more questions without a freaking doubt. But we don't have that right now. We have conjecture. We have a parent who says he takes photos all the time. He's always doing this. It's really weird that he wasn't using his phone then. Okay, if I were a parent and I knew that about my kid, I would probably feel that way too. But then you have every other child out there from other boats and anybody who's out on the water or goes out on the water on a regular basis that has nothing to do with this case, never met these people, not even in the same vicinity. I've heard over and over again, a lot of times people just leave their phones on the boat because they don't want their $1,500 hand computer getting destroyed or lost. Mm-hmm. I was just out on a boat a couple weeks ago. You know what my initial thought was? I'm going to get a lot of really fun shots out here in the water. And then we're about to go in and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to leave it on the boat. And so did everyone else. Yep. And this is a common occurrence on boats. If you've not been out on a boat in the water, jumping in the water, where you have the option to take your phone. You could also very easily lose it. And you're going to be sitting there like this the whole time, not actually enjoying your time in the water. You may leave the phone on the boat. And if it turns out that all the other friends left their phones on the boat, which they claim they did, and his is there, that's not incongruent with the rest of the group. That's him doing exactly what the rest of the group was doing. And it's not that impossible then to think that maybe his phone was still on the boat when they left. And if he was not getting on the boat, that they left without the phone.
I've done it.
And I mean, again, should it be investigated? Without a doubt.
Yep.
But is it a far-fetched, tall tale, sci-fi horror story that this is an impossibility that he could not possibly have left his phone on the boat and not taken it in the water with him?
It's reasonable. So
completely reasonable.
And that's what you got. You know, every time you do an investigation, you got to go for the simplest explanation first. And is that explanation reasonable for the situation? And you, if you don't have personal experience or data doing something like that, you go to people that have. I have done this exact same thing. You've done this exact same thing. You know, so one of the questions I'd be asking, because I love the idea. Every time you come up with. And even with social media, if people come up with these wild theories, all right, ask questions to flush that out. That's what we do here. I love flushing out all these things because then it helps people critically think through anything so you can actually come back to center again. And so one of the questions I'd be asking is, what kind of cell phone case did he have? I have this one, which I wear around as a wallet, and I have one when I go walking in the rain. I actually switch out my cell phone to a waterproof one when I'm actually going to do something different. If I'm going backpacking, I got a separate one for that. So I'd be asking that question. From everything we understand, a group of people left their cell phones on the boat. That's completely reasonable because we heard there's very limited to bad cell phone reception. They're going to be involved in a lot of things. If you're running around shirtless and shorts, sand everywhere, you don't want to get in your electronics. Are you going to have it on you? Are you going to leave it someplace? Because you all agree this is, we're going to leak our cell phones. And when a boat takes off and you're having a good time, maybe having some sort of beverage, whether it's adult beverage or not, you're not necessarily immediately thinking about that. All these things to me are reasonable and not a wobble yet.
And I want to address this because somebody here said, these are middle-aged men referring to us. Kids are keeping their phones close. I don't care where they are. That's a fact. No, it's not at all. Not remotely. When's the last time you were out on the water with a bunch of people of that age? I was out with family and there was teenagers recently. There's tons of teenagers who have spoken up about this exact same thing, saying this is what they do. So no, I'm sorry, you're simply wrong. That is not a fact.
My kids do this very thing. Matter of fact, my daughter is a little bit older than he is. Her new husband, they got a lake house down in Southern Virginia from their family that they go to. They do what they just did is exactly what my daughter and her husband do too.
So. They do. I mean, and I'm sorry, these kids are out in number one, they're in a spot that has no signal. So you're not using Snapchat, which I also found to be kind of an interesting point too, where, you know, they say the family did get the phone and they looked at Snapchat within 24 hours and there was nothing there. Okay, look at it. Dig into Snapchat, get to Snapchat, find out what the hell happened. But it's not, if there's no signal, you're not posting anything to Snapchat.
But that's what
time either.
And then explore it. You know, it's like, hey, not dismissing it, saying, all right, if you think it's, then this is what they're asking in the interviews.
Yes,
You do the interviews.
Yes, exactly. Like, examine it. But all the kids are also going, nobody has signal out here, which they don't. I don't want to lose my phone because I'm going to have a drink in one hand and I'm going to be playing in the water. So you want to be like this the whole time? No, I mean, and if you look up, probably a lot of people don't have their phones in their hands. Again, this is just normal. This is not abnormal behavior out there in the water, on the sandbar, in a place like this. It is not. Anyone who thinks it is simply hasn't lived it, hasn't been there. And it's fine to think that it's crazy for a teenager not to have the phone in hand. I would think so too, but there are certain scenarios, this happens to be one of them, where that would likely occur, where you would have the deviation from them sitting at home or wherever they are with their phone attached to their body surgically.
And it doesn't matter what we think anyway. That's what the interviews are for. That's why you interview
them. Exactly.
And they all said in an interview that they put them on the vote. Okay.
Yeah.
And if everyone's saying the same thing and they're separated during the interviews, that's congruent and it's not a wobble. It's reasonable. Everything comes down reasonable. Is it a reasonable explanation? So far, but that's why we keep interviewing. We keep investigating. We see what the autopsy says. We see what the data says. Mm-hmm. Because people say there's no cell phone. I'd be out there because law enforcement's out there testing cell phone pings, because I guarantee you they're doing that because they want to identify as many people out there as possible to see what cell phones are associated with what people, to make sure they did interview someone. Because if there's a gap, in other words, say they interviewed 60 people, but you have 61 cell phones that are registered that are coming in on a cell tower that were doing that periodic pinging, right? You really think that law enforcement's not going to find out that 61st person, because that one person might have all the information they need. So that's what I guarantee any good law enforcement that's not trying to cover something up will do.
Well, I also wanted to run through his cell phone being on the boat, going back to the house. because that's being looked at as rather suspicious as well. And I get the angle. I get how you could look at that, especially if you're the parent. Like, what the hell's going on? If all those friends thought that this is before they knew anything had happened, before they knew he was like missing and all that. And if you're driving back and you see your friend's phone on the boat, oh shit, he forgot his phone. Well, we'll just give it back to him when we see him next time. That's the end of that thought. It's like, okay, well, when we catch back up with him on shore, we get it. It's not necessarily super nefarious, exactly. You know, they look it up, they find it. I don't think there's really no evidence anyone was trying to hide this phone. The second they located where it was, they got it to the parents. Mm-hmm. Nobody like destroyed the phone. Nobody crushed the phone. Nobody threw it into the ocean, which might have been probably the easiest way to lose the phone. They had the best of all the places you could dispose of something never to find it again. They had the opportunity if they really wanted to. They didn't take it because if there's nothing nefarious going on here, their thought was probably next time we see Nolan, we're going to give him his phone back.
Yeah. And if you think about it too, if you go back to the argument of teenagers always have their cell phones with them, well, obviously not, because if he did, he would have drowned with a cell phone and we never would have got it.
Yeah.
Or would have been waterlogged. So, I mean, that's part of the questions you ask when you're interviewing someone is like, all right, when did you realize you had a cell phone? He didn't have it. And what actions did you take? And what time did you take them? And then when they give you their timeline of what they did, when they give back to the parents, you're collaborating that information with what the parents say. Again, is everyone being congruent? Because what you're always doing as an interviewer, you're looking for open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. Those are the three signs of trust I'm looking for. I'm looking for behavioral congruence between words, actions, and deeds. I'm looking for transparency and maintaining the same tempo of transparency when I ask you a further question, a follow-on question, a more probing question. I'm looking for that same level, and that's what good interviewers and investigators are doing. And so far, from what we're seeing on the outside, from what's being reported, I'm still not seeing wobbles yet, but maybe there are there, but that's what investigators are finding out. But that's exactly what they're doing right now.
I want to touch on this other one I just saw in the comments section, because I just talked about it. I just did a piece on this, breaking down the timeline of this case, which you can watch here later today as we post it. If you're a member on our YouTube, it drops tomorrow for free. The dad's account of him retrieving the phone keys was interesting. He felt they were being deceptive. At first, they say they can't find it. That was the keys they couldn't find initially. The phone, they apparently gave right up. And I read that account, and it basically, the dad's, through conjecture, basically was reiterating to whoever made the statement that he felt like there was deception going on there. Look, if my kid was missing and all these friends who I trusted, you know, him to be around for all this time don't know anything, I would feel they were being deceptive too, whether they were or not, quite honestly. I'd be feeling deception from any human being at that moment in time because I don't know where my kid is. So I don't blame him one iota for feeling like maybe there's deception going on, because you're going to be looking for that. You're going to be suspicious. So I get that. But again, a feeling is not a fact. And it doesn't matter how close you are to the victim or not. Feelings are not facts. It is what it is. It's understandable why he has those feelings. I don't blame him. I think most of us would feel the same way, especially if you're freaking out, your son's missing, and you got some flippant teenagers that are just kind of like, I don't know. They also probably don't understand the gravity of the situation at that moment either. The keys were an interesting thing, but again, I also was like, would this feel different if this kid weren't missing? Because initially they said they couldn't find Nolan's keys. And the boys didn't know where the keys were, but one of the girls said, I think they're on the Xbox. Boom, they're on the Xbox. Right. So you have a group of teenage boys that doesn't know where their friend set his own keys. And one of the girls is the one that goes, oh, I saw him on the Xbox. How is that not a regular Tuesday with a bunch of 18, 19-year-olds if a parent is coming to somehow retrieve the keys of their son who's not there to tell them where they are? That seems about par for the course of any 18, 19-year-olds of any race and color, that would be how it would go. The girl paid attention. She saw the keys. The guys, I don't know where they're at. I don't, that doesn't read to me as super suspicious, but I get, again, from the dad's perspective, everything looks suspicious,
right,
and rightfully so.
And to and to what Humble Beginnings said too, and to what you're saying, Tony. So the dad has a feeling and emotion, and I never dismiss feelings and emotions because they're generally created by data, experience. Yeah. And so what I'd be exploring now, so the dad says they seem deceptive. So the next question an interviewer and investigator asks is, all right, so what makes you say that? A what question, not why, a what. You know, has one of the kids involved in your son's life given you reason to not believe him ever? In other words, I'm going to look for data points to say whether this came from this emotion you have about deception and the strife and horrible trauma you're going through. Is that emotion you're having caused from data you've collected from his group of friends over the years? Or is it something that you've seen from society? Is it an experience that you had growing up? In other words, I need to differentiate where that your emotions coming from. Is it coming from something you saw in that group of friends that gave you reason to pause in this instant as well because they have an arc of behavior? Or is it coming from something else in your life, like this horrendous situation you're going through?
Yeah. And a cacophony of people trying to attach themselves to you going,
yes.
Well, it's this. It must be this. I can get you all this attention. That to me feels very predatory on a family in grief.
Yeah, and because, what you don't want is someone feeding him ideas that aren't original. But that's why, good investigators, very empathetic, caring ones that are doing these interviews that are very, very skilled with, I'm hoping they are, and they most likely are, dealing with people that are going through severe trauma right now, is you're helping them move through theories and conjectures and what people are feeding them as thoughts and ideas and move into, the areas of facts that the investigators can work through. Because you're not going to ever dismiss what the parents are saying, but it'll help you as an investigator create filters. All right, I need to pay attention to this or not pay attention here, move over here. And so that's why just asking, so what makes you say that about these kids? And or in this moment, was it something the kids have done in the past? Was there one friend in particular that gave you a wobble? And give me an exact example. Because you're going to need some data in order to drill deeper. Very specific. Not, like you said, not the emotion of it. Emotions are caused by actions. I need you to tell me the action that was taken. Was it taken over here or was it taken over here? Because if it's over here, I don't need to pay attention to this.
Yeah. Feelings are not facts. Right. Everyone is certainly entitled to them, but they are just that. It's heartbreaking all around. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd be out of my freaking mind if I were that dad right now. He's acting far more, competent. I think I'd be in a corner shaking. I think. I mean, I don't know. I would. I can't imagine. I can't freaking imagine. So I'm not casting judgment at all on them, but I am just trying to look at this from a middle of the road perspective. Could it be this? Could it be that? We don't know the answer to any of this yet. But let's not jump down all of the roads of conjecture and attach our boats to them, no pun intended. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue to follow this wherever it will go. 100%. Yeah, let's go over to another case that is rearing its head this week, finally. Lindsay Clancy, a January night in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Patrick Clancy left home to go pick up takeout and came back to the end of his entire world. His wife, Lindsay, was on the ground beneath a second-story window, and Cora, Dawson, and a baby, Callan, were in the basement. 3.5 years later, she's finally facing a jury. 18 of them, more than they seated for Karen Reed, on 3 counts of first-degree murder. Her lawyers say 13 prescriptions broke her brain, which they did, and prosecutors say she planned it. Yeah, just on her own. Never mind the 13, antipsychotics going in and out of her system every other day. And every message you've seen lands on the same impossible question. Can a mother be sick and guilty at the same time? Your thoughts as we break this down in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, here to help us discuss. Can she be guilty and sick at the same time, Robin?
That's a great question. This is the most horrendous case to me because there's 3 babies that are dead because of her, and that needs to be accounted for, which she owns. But because, like you said, all these medications, misprescribed, whatever the reason, broke her brain. And she had a psychotic, what is being claimed by defense, a psychotic episode. It's a one-off. because she does not have a behavior arc or pattern of having done these horrendous things in the past. In the sense of, you know, although she said it, she made threats, she sought help. So I don't know how the two. I'm glad I'm not on that jury.
I want to throw. Let's This is for whatever reason in 2026, we still can't wrap our minds in this country around the fact that our minds involve health as well. It's not just our other organs that can get unhealthy. Our brains can get very unhealthy, and that happens to be the originating source for about 90-some% of the problems in our country. Unhealthy brains, yet so many places are like, we're not even going to consider your mental health. It's either you're bad or you're good. Your brain has nothing to do with it. Let's just go down a route here, a thought experiment, if you will. Let's say there was something else wrong with Lindsay Clancy, or anybody for that matter, and the doctors prescribed 13 different medications, on and off, on and off, on and off, different dosage, up it, lower, take it off, don't do this one. But you're talking to different doctors. Nobody's communicating about this between them, the doctors, because that's how the system's set up to fail or work. It is what it is. That's how the system works. Quote unquote, doesn't mean it's effective, but that's how it functions, I should say. So let's say you do this and you get on off all these medications and eventually it totally fucks up your heart in some way, shape or form. It's just, it's not beating right. It's irregular. It's going off the charts and it's a very unhealthy state. But you're in that state because you raised your hand and went to doctors and said, there's something wrong with my heart. I need help for this. And they bounce you around to all this. And at the end of the day, you have a heart attack and you're driving your car and it goes off a cliff with your kids in it. And you're in it too. Is that because of you? Or is that because of the 13 different medications that totally fucked up your body and didn't help anything, even though you were trying to get help and ended up killing everyone because one hand couldn't communicate with the other within the medical community? Take the brain out of it. If it was a different organ that killed everybody, would we be having the same conversation?
Yeah, it's a great thought experiment because the question I ask is, I'm very curious about it, it'll hopefully come out in trial, is, so they're bouncing around medications, and as a psychiatrist, they're trying to figure out what's broken in the brain. They're trying to medicate the brain, and that can be very, very difficult, as we've seen in all these scenarios. I've known people, you've known people, and going on these micro milligrams sometimes of the chemicals needed to bring that brain back into healthy balance is very difficult. I'm curious about what advice they told her, what she could and couldn't do after they said her brain was or wasn't fixed. Because I think there, to me, the culpability is going to lie in the fact of, did they say she shouldn't have contact with her kids because of them being imbalanced? Or did they say, no, you're good to go to have contact with everyone? I think that'd be I'm interested in that question as well, because, like, to your point, you know, if, you know, going back to your thought experiment, if the doctor said, no, you're good to go, but then you have a heart attack and kill everyone in your car, what culpability does the doctor have saying you're good to go and you still wind up having a heart attack? These are tough questions.
Well, and I mean, there's a lot of issues in this story where one could go, well, we could have prevented it this way. Yeah, but we didn't. And we have no protocol to do so. And people aren't necessarily thinking automatically worst case scenario when you're dealing with something like this. We talked the other day, should Patrick have gone out to get takeout when he knew that his wife had said that she felt these feelings before about her harming the children? Probably not. But it might have been a good day. And he might have just made a really bad judgment call. And again, when you're in that scenario, when you have a partner that, you know, previous to this had never, you know, made some, you know, comments of that nature, and this is all new territory for yourself as well. You don't know. I mean, you take it seriously, but unfortunately, as humans, until we really see the end all consequences, we don't quite sometimes grasp how serious these situations are. So, you know, should he have stayed home? Maybe, you know, I mean, should the system have taken the kids out of the house? I mean, maybe, I mean, it, maybe he should have moved them somewhere. But again, you get to like really somewhat unfeasible territory, or territory that is just not going to be the common reaction of ordinary human beings to prevent something like this. I get stuck on the medications. I mean, this is someone, and that's what gets me about this damn case. It's not like she was sitting there and they were like trying to convince her to take them. She was raising her hand. I need help. I need something. And whether, you know, I don't know that necessarily the medical community was, you know, intentionally trying to hurt her, but they do when they don't communicate with one another and they don't know who's prescribing what and how it's being communicated, which way and that way. All the more lesson, honestly, for the rest of us of why you have to be your own advocate when you're talking to a doctor and don't rely on the system reading their charts correctly because they don't. But I don't know that there really was a realistic or reasonable, foreseeable prevention method for any of this. More than they were already taking, more than she was already taking on her own behest.
Yeah, you really hit the key word. And everyone's comments, I completely agree. These are questions that need to be asked and addressed. But that one word, reasonable, from what we've seen being presented in the public forum anyway, they were not flippant about what was going on with her.
Not
they weren't
at all.
Dismissive of it. They were doing all they could. They addressed it. She had a level of transparency and no shame with the fact that she needed medication. So, again, one of the comments was she telling her doctors everything? Well, she appeared to be, because she was being very transparent. She's a medical professional herself. She's a nurse, labor and delivery nurse. I mean, this is what they do, you know, because you can only get better and you expect your patients to share everything so you can treat them effectively. So I saw a reasonable effort from what we saw on the outside, but that's what the trial is going to really dig down on, was everyone doing as much as they reasonably could. And was anyone being flippant about the medication? Were they flipping about the expectations of her mental health? I mean, we're just not seeing it on the outside, but that's what these jurors are going to have to wade through because this is horrible. It's a horrible case.
It is. A new development over the weekend, according to the Boston Globe. This is the Globe's reporting, not ours. I was trying to find records on it. I did so much digging and then stopped, but I'm going to try and dig more this weekend. I'm assuming this is probably accurate, but again, Boston Globe reporting this. The straight from her lawyer that they're divorced. This is new. This is a new thing. I'm not surprised. Apparently, they're divorced. He's remarried and has moved to New York, according to the Boston Globe, which apparently got that reporting from her attorney. The narrative thus far in the public has been that, you know, they're still married. He's standing by her side. He's still standing by her side. That's not changed. But the fact that they are divorced, that does seem to be a new piece to the story or understanding of the current situation. How do you think that affects this case, if at all, when the jury looks at it going, oh my gosh, well, he got divorced and he remarried. Does it affect it at all, or does it not? It's fairly realistic to expect your wife is in a mental health facility for the rest of her life. You might end up getting divorced and remarried, not because you don't love her or care about her or want the best for her well-being, but because you'd like to also live the rest of your life as well.
I think it's going to depend on the reason behind it. It's like, what caused the divorce? If that's the case, I'm looking it up right now.
Probably this.
So right now I'm seeing they're not divorced. So let's just go down this conjecture. We've seen this before. You know, we have Asa Ellerup. She divorced Rex, but she's standing by his side regardless. So that was a financial aspect of it. We have, what's her phrase? Ruby Frankie's husband refused to divorce her, yet he probably should have. I think they're divorced now, though.
Yeah.
It really comes down to what's the intent. And I, you know, it kind of struck me. You know, the first thing that popped in my mind was the Delphi case. And here's why, is because he was always focused on her well-being. You know, Richard Allen's focused on his wife's well-being. And so I'd be curious about what spurred on, if they are divorced, if they are separated. Was it her saying, you need to get away from me, you need to move on, you need to protect yourself? Or was it him saying, I need to distance myself from your nutterness? So I think understanding that is what we need to have, if that is indeed true, that they are divorced or separated. But I'm seeing
Most places, the Globe is the only one that's been reporting that over the weekend. But I mean, it's a reliable newspaper. So
I'm not dismissing it. It's a thought experiment. But I wouldn't. Yeah. As of right now, they would have to explore for me what was the impetus for it. What was it because of the trial, financial? I mean, there's a lot of reasons.
I would guess. I mean, my conjecture. Just moving on with your life. I mean, you can otherwise you're basically taking care of the person in the mental health facility, you really can't do it. They have to do it. And I don't know. I mean, it's not a crazy thought. I mean, I could see, I don't know.
I could see him getting divorced so that whatever penalties that she faces, it doesn't bleed onto him.
That's true. Yeah.
And so I could see it for that reason. But given, again, only from what we see in the public eye and how they stuck together and how they worked together on all this, it's hard to imagine emotionally them separating for an emotional disconnect, because I see them pretty tight.
The public is very shocked by this case. How could a mother think of this? How could a mother think of harming their own children? And I mean, it's really, it's not funny. It's kind of, it's bizarre to me. It shows a level of disconnect from reality that the general public has on this subject, because it's icky and people like to talk about it and it makes them feel uncomfortable. But it's such a reality. This is a comment that says, I had postpartum with my second and the intrusive thoughts scare me so much. I've never told a soul. This is exactly why moms stay quiet. It is exactly why moms stay quiet, because if you do tell a soul that you're having these intrusive thoughts, the world can come down on you. And you don't get judged because of the condition you're in. You get judged as a human being by so many people because they don't understand mental health. They don't want to understand mental health. They just want to virtue signal that they're smarter and better and stronger than you, because it didn't happen to me. So how could it happen to you? That's why women don't talk about this. And I think it's also why the public has no freaking clue about it, because it's such a scary thing for women to talk about. Because if you say you had those thoughts while going through postpartum, most of the public is stupid enough to go 20 years later, do you still think about killing your kids? No, it's because of the mental health situation they were in at that moment in time. But then again, you're trying to rely on competent people to have the conversation with, which we're rather short of these days. Do you think that's part of why we have such a problem with the public understanding this, because of the fear of talking about what our brains are capable of doing?
Yeah, it's a lack of context from experience that people have on such horrendous things. Also, I do, because we keep hitting a generational thing today on in multiple cases, it's also a generational thing too. I'm a Gen Xer. I know you are, Tony. When you come up from a generation of just grin, bear it, and shut up and suck it up, that's what generally happens. I lost a very close, my wife and I both lost a friend from high school from postpartum. She self-eliminated in a very horrendous way because of it. Never in a million years would you ever suspect a very, very beautiful, successful young woman, and it's horrendous.
Yeah.
But the positive, it's funny, we're hitting some really positive notes today with the current generation. Basically, they're colorblind. They're very accepting. And one thing also this current generation is, because my daughter is part of it, my son too, very much into, if you need therapy, she'll be the first one to throw you into it. And there's no shame with it. So this is a generation that, unlike our generation of the shame, the stigma, that doesn't nearly exist. I know it exists in pockets and it's still there, but I think it's being flushed out more and more because people are more open to the fact that, hey, I think everyone understands we're all broken. We're all working on something. There's no shame to be working on something, because the only people in life that you really shouldn't trust are the ones that say they got it all going on right.
One more of this. I saw a comment, justice for those three innocent children. What is justice for those three innocent children? Is it locking up and throwing away the key on the mom who had postpartum psychosis, who begged for help from many different providers, who couldn't get the right hand to understand what the left hand was doing, basically poisoned her brain left and right in all these medications? And then when her brain acted the way it would, when you get that big of a mix of antipsychotics and other things in there that she acted out the way she did while she was begging for help. Is it justice to lock her away for the rest of her life in a prison where she can't be in a mental health facility, which is what she's asking for? She's not asking to go back out on the street and shit out more kids. She's asking to be locked away in a mental health facility because she knows there was something wrong with her and she's so damn traumatized by what happened, she's never going to be whole again. So what exactly is justice for those three kids in this case, the bumper sticker slogan that ignorant people like to throw out there?
I think justice is learning from having the medical facilities, medical professionals learning from this so it doesn't happen again. That's justice.
Yeah.
I mean, and this mom, you know, be the research tool that they can use to figure it out better next time so she can be the reason why it doesn't happen again.
Justice is not pretending this wasn't a mental health crisis. And it's, if you're going with the prosecution, it's pretending this wasn't a mental health crisis. It's pretending she was just this evil, wretched woman who wanted to murder her three kids while her husband picked up Applebee's. Like, no, that doesn't seem like that. That seems like a narrative somebody wants to go on that doesn't think deeply at all. Justice is exactly, I agree 1,000%, Robin. It's looking at this for what it is and having a better understanding of this shit. So more moms don't have to go through it. So more fathers understand what they need to be looking for and how to handle and how to care for the woman that they love if they're in the situation that Patrick was. That seems more like justice than locking her away and throwing away the key.
Well, think about it. Regardless whether she's innocent by reason of insanity, she's spent her life behind bars in an asylum or whatever it is, or she's guilty and should be behind bars and she's still paralyzed from waist down, so there's nothing more you can really do to her, and you can't bring the kids back. So really the only thing that positive that can come from this positive, I know it's a horrible word to use, but the only justice in this is learn so that we don't repeat our past bad behaviors that caused it in the first place.
Amen. All right. Yes. Now that we solved all the world's problems today, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue these conversations right there. Those links are in the description. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching. Of course, we do this every single day, 11 a.m. Central on YouTube. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books and on audiobook. Go get it. Leave a review. Check it out. You'll love it. Until next time, for Robin and Todd and myself, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.